Hello and welcome to the fifth season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and we're back with brand new weekly episodes where I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Since announcing this season on social media, I've had a lot of really nice comments from listeners and all your feedback is always appreciated. So if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is a content creator who is a campaigner for pro-age, healthy living and all-round positivity. Julie, who goes by the social media title The 50ist, uses her platform to speak about the pressures, challenges and bias against age and ageing in society. She's an advocate for natural products in beauty and well-being, and after choosing to stop dyeing her hair, allowing it to transition to its natural silver colour, she's one of a growing number of women who, in a space which has previously attracted negativity, are finding a rich vein of confidence and what Julie likes to call sass. Julie, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I was checking out your socials, obviously, doing a bit of research before we chatted. And a few times you've posted about podcasts that you like and that you're subscribed to.
Yes.
Yeah, what have you got on your subscriptions at the moment?
I love a podcast. I'm a big fan of podcasts, but I haven't got the widest range, but I have some that I really enjoy. And they're all usually about kind of how to improve your life, how to improve your diet. I'm all for self-improvement and what can I do? What can I change if I've got a problem? I'm inspired by them. I really like listening to them because they motivate me. So things like, I love Brené Brown. Diary of a CEO, I think, is wonderful. I think Stephen Bartlett is absolutely brilliant. Just a wonderful interviewer. I'm saying this in front of you, which is weird, isn't it? But he's an amazing interviewer. So I really enjoy how he brings people out and the questions he asks. And the kind of range of topics. He has lots of women on there. I do find that some of the really big podcasts don't feature women enough. So yeah, absolutely. I love podcasts. And I also particularly like, just to stick one in, there's a cancer and menopause one by Danny Binnington, and that's wonderful. And that has come out in the last year and is doing really well.
Do you have a ritual when it comes to listening? Do you have a little nook? Or do you do it when you're walking the dog?
I'm doing it when I walk the dog. Or if I'm doing makeup, or if I'm cooking, I'll stick it on the side and I'll just pop it on and say I'm peeling veg or something, you know, making dinner, I can stick it on. Just any time when I'm, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I never sit down to listen to one. Or I have it in the car. You know, I'm always doing something and listening, and I really enjoy that. I enjoy that kind of special time that I get to do that thing and be occupied by learning. I don't really listen to sort of fictional ones, or I quite like to listen to some true story ones if I could, but I never seem to get to that because I'm so interested in all the things, all the learning and the, you know, I feel like a sponge.
And are you someone who will give things a few episodes before you make a decision, or are you quite ruthless when it comes to new discoveries?
I kind of like a bit of a format, if I'm honest. I like it to have a structure so I can know what to expect, the style of content, and then most of them do, really. I'm not so keen on ones where people are just talking themselves, although some are, you know, some are interesting. I really like the ones where they do compilations of all the good things that they've done over the last year, so I always listen to those. Yeah, I'm a sucker for a podcast. I've just started Audible as well, which is great.
And have you been a guest on any podcast before, or is this your first?
This is my first podcast.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I was quite nervous, actually.
How does it feel?
It feels nice. Yeah, it's just a conversation, isn't it? So it's fine. But I've done a few lives on Instagram.
Yes. Yeah,
I've seen some of those. So I've done a couple of things on there, which that's quite nerve-wracking too. And, you know, I don't know how many people have watched them, but it's still that moment where you actually realise that people could be listening in their daily lives, and what you say may have, you know, may not be that important, but may have some impact on somebody, and you don't get a chance to take that back. You know, it's what comes out is what comes out, and there's a little weight of responsibility in that, you know.
So we're in South Somerset.
We are.
How long have you been based in this part of the woods?
We've been down here since 2001, as we came down, so over 20 years now. And we came down because my daughter was changing schools, and so we were looking for a really good school for her. We were looking to move anyway, and I was actually going through breast cancer treatment at the time. And although we were sort of looking, it wasn't set in stone. We came down here for a weekend because my dad lives here as well. My dad, well, he used to live here. And we came down to visit them, and they were supposed to be coming up to see us. We were living in Hertfordshire at the time, and they were supposed to be coming to us for the weekend. And because I was having treatment for the breast cancer, I didn't feel particularly well. And we just wanted to get away. We were just like, can we come down to you for a change? So we travelled down and came down and arrived, I think, on the Saturday morning or something. And we drove past this house to get to my dad's house. And this was a house that I'd always said to my husband, if that house comes up for sale, we got to buy that house. And because of the location, and has a little stream in the garden, and it's just a great place. And we drove past it and it was for sale. And if we hadn't come down instead of them coming up, we wouldn't have known that it was for sale. And my dad was looking after the garden, we had the keys, and we came in and had a look, and we were like, oh shit. And it was nothing like it is now. It was it was a project basically, which is still ongoing. But it went from there, and my husband changed his job to work down here. I changed my job to work down here, and then it just happened. There was a good school for my daughter, and we just moved down. So that's how we ended up down here. And I'd come down here since I was a teenager, because my dad lived down here, and always loved it.
So you knew the area, you knew what you were getting into?
A little bit, because having only sort of come down for weekend visits and things, or the odd week here and there, I hadn't really seen very much of the area. Been down to the coast, the donkey sanctuary, you know, things that you do when you're more of a child or a teenager. But once we arrived here, incredibly rural compared to where we lived, in a town, we couldn't believe how quiet it was, how close we are. We're literally a minute and you're in fields. Pretty soon we got a dog, so it was our first puppy, and, you know, I'd never had a dog, and we just were out and about, and it is stunning. And we live near ancient hollows that you can walk up, and they are unbelievably beautiful, especially first thing in the morning, you know, misty, the views. Oh, it is a stunning place to live. You obviously appreciate it because you know, the podcast's about Somerset, isn't it?
One of the great benefits of doing this podcast is getting to explore parts of Somerset that I don't live in. So, you know, there's a great drive between where we are and over to Bridgewater. There's a sort of ridge that has the levels on one side.
I know where you are.
And you go past old windmills. It's really beautiful. Mm. And so that's a road that I wouldn't normally go on. And there are little parts and little nuggets. There's a village that I drove through on the way here that I'd never been through before. And I was stunned. It was just gorgeous. So, I get to explore, and I get to put the spotlight on parts of and people in Somerset that I really enjoy doing as well. You were telling me just before we started recording that your childhood, you were moving around quite a lot.
Yes, my dad was in the Navy. And as a child, I think I went to 11 schools. We moved around the country a lot. We spent some time in the Far East, in Hong Kong. I had a couple of years there in my early childhood, sort of between sort of 6 and 8. And then came back and settled in Kent. And then I ended up in London, and then I met my husband, and things kind of went from there. But yeah, I've moved around a lot. But this is the place I've lived the longest. So it has a really special place in my heart. And there's just some utterly stunning places. And we spent some time in Wales, that's where I had my daughter. And Wales is just rural, and I'd say, no offence, there's some stunningly beautiful places in Wales, but it's actually prettier here, which kind of appeals as well. I like the stone that you get, the sandstone.
It's very bucolic, isn't it?
Yeah. And yeah, it really appeals. And I love Wales, don't get me wrong. I don't want to offend anyone who's Welsh, because I'm Welsh. I was born in Wales. But there's something much more, just much more...
It's quite dramatic.
Yes.
Whereas I think here you get to absorb the natural beauty in a more calm and relaxed way.
Yes.
I think what maybe some of the landscapes in Wales do is challenge you with, this is the drama of what nature can do.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different strings to your bow, but the one thing that kind of is recurrent through everything that you do is writing and words. Mm-hmm. Did you have a passion for words and reading from a young age as well?
Absolutely. I've always loved reading, words, English. I read voraciously as a child, and but all for the time, things like Enid Blyton, things that possibly at times aren't very PC now, but you know, adventure stories, magical things, very creative things. I used to love horror stories. I went through a big phase of reading all the Agatha Christie books, and I just read and read and read as a child and a young adult, and always loved words. Did well at school with English, and then came back to English actually when I was 40. I decided to do a degree, so I did an English language and literature degree via the OU. I did it part time, and it took me 6 years. And I loved that. Hard but brilliant, and it changed. It changed how I write, and I'm writing at the moment. I can't really talk very much about the book I'm writing, but I am writing. I'm writing a book of short stories. I'm also writing another book, which is a non-fiction book, and that's out on proposal at the moment. And I'm excited about that. So, and I write little articles for Tangled Silver, which is an online magazine. That's all to do with the silver hair thing, which is another sort of angle.
Which we will get on to very shortly. The other thing that I noticed, I said I'd kind of been, you know, stalking your socials, is that pre your content and your writing about Silver Sisters and about the kind of healthy aging and all that kind of stuff, there's quite a lot of food content, and you mentioned cooking earlier as well. Yes. So is that another passion of yours?
Do you know, I'm going to confess now, I'm a foodie in the sense that I absolutely love going out and eating food that other people have made, and I enjoy making, I enjoy cooking, but nothing pleases me more than making a meal that will last 2 days so I don't have to cook 2 days on the job. And part of the reason is I don't want to spend the time, I don't want to spend lots of time doing it, and once I get into it, I'm enjoying it, but it's just, I don't know how to say it. I do really enjoy it. Food is passion. I love food. Cooking, the actual physical cooking of it, not so much. Yeah. But that's changed recently. And the reason it's changed is because I've changed my diet. And over the last couple of years, I've gone gradually more plant-based. And so I've had to change how I cook. And seeing a lot of information online, and some family friends have bought me books. And I absolutely love making those new recipes, which I've really enjoyed lately. Like, you're supposed to eat 30 different fruit and veg a week. Trying to shoehorn that in is pretty hard. And so I'm making things like, you know, lots of things with beans, lots of things with tofu, which I've never done. I was to shy away from beans for the obvious reason, but find that I'm actually, now I'm eating more of them, I'm tolerating them much better. So that's for anyone out there who might be considering upping their fiber intake. Your body does get used to it. You know, I don't know how personal, is that too personal?
Let's change tack a little. At this point, I want to talk about age. Now, maybe it's me being terribly traditional, but even though this is clearly going to be a talking point for our conversation, I can't help but feel a little bit uncomfortable bringing up the subject. And you describe yourself as pro-age. So I have two questions here. Firstly, what does that mean? And secondly, is my awkwardness a part of the problem that the conversation about age faces in our society?
Brilliant question. Absolutely brilliant. So pro-age is, so societally, there's a bias towards youth. And historically, that's a construct that's been in place for hundreds of years, maybe longer, And there's been a sea change in how women see themselves, I think, over the last few years particularly. things like the Me Too movement, just some societal movements, some hashtag things that came out about age positivity, the fact that you don't have to apologize for your age, basically. There's no shame in getting older, because I think for a long time, women have felt uncomfortable in their skins as they age. So they felt like, and the beauty industry and society as a whole has created negativity around aging. So women have felt shame in aging. So the pro-age movement is really saying, it's okay to age, it's okay to show how old you are, and there shouldn't be any judgment around that. So it's positive. Aging, for me particularly, having faced my mortality twice, I'm just flipping lucky to be here and really glad about it. So every week and month and year that goes by for me is a blessing. You know, I'm not religious, but that's how it feels to me. It's an honour still to be here. So why would I be sad that I've got some wrinkles and the whole silver hair thing, I know you're probably going to come on to that, but why should I be ashamed of that? Why should I be pressured into trying to look 24 when I'm 56? Why is that a thing? And it's absolutely ingrained in our society. And what's really interesting is, because ageism is never in style, pro-aging is in style, if you like. Lots of the massive companies now have jumped on that bandwagon, and they don't use anti-aging in their adverts as much, which is a positive thing. They're not saying buy this. Well, some of them are still. L'Oreal, you know, there are brands that still do that, but a lot of them are saying look refreshed, or plump up your skin, or those kinds, rather than saying here's a cream that's going to make you look 10 years younger. Because it just makes people feel bad about themselves, you know, or feel like they have to, or women have to rush, and men have to rush to buy this thing. They're pressured to buy it, because if they don't, they're going to be looking older. And there's, again, shame and embarrassment in that. And it's such a stupid construct, isn't it? Society shouldn't be pigeonholing people like that. Women are women. They have enough pressure from every single angle in their lives. You know, look great, but don't look too great, or someone will bring you down. You know, you've got to have it all, but you've also got to be a great mother and look after your children in the best way possible and bring them up with no problems. You've got to be everything to your husband, you know, or to your partner. You've got to meet all of these criteria. I'm not saying there isn't pressure on men. There is pressure on men to perform in certain ways societally as well. But there's so much pressure on women that I'm really glad that things are shifting towards a pro-age viewpoint, that it's okay. Who cares? You know, and I like to look nice. You can see that by my profile. I take nice pictures. But I've also taken pictures of myself with no makeup, and showing the fact that I have rosacea and I have wrinkles, and you know, I'm not ashamed of that. It's just it's frustrating to be part of that, but also, or to have been influenced by that for my whole life, but heartening to see a community of women that I'm part of, and also a pro-age community of younger women as well and older women, saying actually we're not having that. And we're going to be how we want to be, and being comfortable in your own skin. That's the kind of crux of it, and not feeling like you have to apologise to anyone for it.
In your musings, in your thinking about this, do you ever consider or look at cultures where maybe that isn't the case, where age and older people are more revered, more respected, and being old is not something that is to be, you know, shut away and forgotten about?
I know about them. Because I have a family member who lives abroad, and they live in the Far East. And there, it is exactly like that. Older people, white-haired people, you know, are revered, and they're respected, and they're not, they're kept within, a lot more within the family group. But that doesn't seem to translate into all cultures. And there are also cultures who are even harsher on their women than Western cultures, because things like hair dye, it is absolutely against the grain to let your hair go silver. Some of the South American countries are very, very on that. I've read some information about that, which is, it must be very difficult. I know in the Indian communities as well, some of the women that I know online have gone against the grain, again, by allowing their hair to go silver at a younger age than is deemed acceptable. So it is, it's interesting, the culturally. And I want to just jump back to what you were saying about, is that why you feel uncomfortable? Can I ask you, do you feel uncomfortable talking about age?
It's a funny thing because I have two young daughters and they are at the stage of life where they don't have as many societal filters in what they think and in what they say and in what they ask. And so they'll go against that societal norm that you never ask a lady what her age is. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that it's a weird tradition. It's something that you sort of hear and you think, okay, well, I should never talk about age with a woman or anyone who's old or anything like that.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange thing that I believe is imprinted from quite an early stage, but yet shapes our view on how we interact with people as we all get older.
But isn't it silly that you you shouldn't ask someone how old they are? That we can't be open about how old we are?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
That historically, you know, some people have lied about how old they are. It's such a fascinating thing. And hopefully by the time your daughters are older, that won't be so much the case. And you can obviously influence that. But it's also when people say, you look young for your age or something. That isn't something we should say to people. We're just the age we are. It shouldn't matter whether you look older or younger. It's just, that's just promoting that you should look younger. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
All the time.
And, I mean, you know, philosophically speaking, it's just a function of time.
Yeah.
Right? It's
yeah.
just an amount
Absolutely.
Of time that we've been...
If you step right back from it and think that we're a rock flying through space, populated by clever apes, you know, when you think about the constructs that have been put around things, you can laugh at them when you look at them from such a distance, because it doesn't matter how old someone is or whether they, you know, it's just what was valued is youth. It's valued differently and we're older and that's not valued and that's wrong, because I don't feel any different from how I was when I was 34. When I was maybe, you know, I think when I got into my 30s, I feel like I'm still that kind of energy, that kind of vigor for life, that kind of drive, that kind of ambition, because I had that bit more experience when I got into my 30s. That's where I feel like I kind of sit still. And why shouldn't I feel like that? But society goes, nope, you have to look younger, be younger, you know. And
occasionally you get that sort of trite 40 is the new 30 kind of thing,
yeah.
which sounds great, but actually I think it's a massive simplification of what we as people need to do at this point, because we do have a hugely aging population. We are living longer, more people are living longer, and therefore to reduce it to 40 is the new 30, 50 is the new 40, those things aren't true. It's just we need to be better at understanding what the potential of life is within those decades.
And it's massive, isn't it? And as we age and people are looking after themselves much better, we can expect to live longer. So we want those, that's what I'm saying, stacking the odds is kind of my thing, really. It's about looking after yourself in such a way that you can live a really healthy, long life as free from disease and disability as you can, physically and mentally. So, yeah, I think age is fantastic and we should celebrate it.
For you personally, when did that concept of aging and I am getting older start being something that you were consciously aware of?
Oh, goodness. That's a really hard question, It's just a gradual creep. When you just notice things don't work the way they used to. You know, and each time I think, what can I do about that? Rather than just a thing, that's why the podcasts are so great, because I'm constantly learning about, you know, it's so interesting to learn that way, isn't it? What can I do to help mitigate that? What can I help that instead of just accepting it? I don't think we have to accept it. I think we can go against that. And that's so positive online now. That's open, you know, so much information out there now. It's confusing sometimes because you get conflicting advice all the time. But if you look hard enough, you can find something that suits you and that will make a difference. And yeah, I'm fascinated by that.
How would you describe the relationship that you had with your hair before now?
Before I have the silver hair that I have
yes.
now? Okay. So I like to call it silver hair, by the way, because there's a lot of light in it and it's bright. And grey is such a drab word that I like to call it silver hair. It's grey hair. It's silver hair. The hair I had before, I started dyeing my hair when I was in my teens, and just things like semi-permanence, fun colours, mucking around with it, perms. My sister trained as a beauty therapist and a hairdresser, so although that's not what she went on to do, she was into that at the time, so I was kind of a bit like a guinea pig. And she just tried all different things out on me, which I really enjoyed. I got to my early 20s and I found my first grey hair when I was around 23, and it was shock horror. I was scared of it. I'd never really seen anybody anywhere that had grey hair that wasn't deemed to be an old, ancient person, you know. And a lot of the kind of historical figures, you know, the connotations around women being older, the kind of witchy, you know, ancient, past it, invisible women. That's how I viewed grey-haired women. That's really awful, isn't it? But that was the construct that I came through my early years having, that old grey hair equaled old. And it actually has nothing to do with, it's nothing to do with age, it's to do with pigment. And when you find your first one, it means that you've got a loss of pigment in that hair. It's nothing, it's just a physical thing. So I started dyeing my hair, as in dyeing it in earnest, from about probably late 20s, and so therefore dyed it for over 20 years. And I'm allergic to hair dye. So it gradually got worse and worse and worse. I had stinging and itching, and over years, over many different, trying it many, many different ways. I was determined I was never going to let my hair not be dyed. I tried every different method that you could probably think of, and ended up, because I used to have really dark hair, the same colour as my eyebrows, proper sort of brunette. And obviously that, as the greys came through, that got harder to disguise with dye, and so I ended up having whole head highlights, which I gradually had. We went blonder, so I ended up with all blonde. You can see that on my posts. So the final colour that I had before I started to transition to silver was kind of whole head blonde, which really isn't a colour that suits me particularly well, I have to say. It doesn't really go with my skin tone, but that's where I ended up, just to cover the greys. I was determined not to, you know, nothing was going to make me go grey. It was just not done. I didn't see anybody in the media. No women in the media at that point had grey hair. It was just an invisibility thing. I got to the point where the hair dye was making me feel really poorly, and I was dreading going. I used to have my hair dyed. And again, it wasn't touching my head at this point, it was just in foils. But washing it off would mean it touched my head. And then I'd come home and wash it again, and I'd still have heavy heartbeat, nausea, headaches for a couple of days afterwards, feel completely washed out. And basically it felt like gradual poisoning of myself in the end. That's what I felt like I was doing. And I used to dread going because I started to think I was going to have a really bad reaction. And I look back at myself, Lewis, and I just think, how ridiculous to have gone through that all of those years and still dyed my hair because of the pressure that I felt societally, that I just couldn't consider the fact that I would have to let my hair go grey.
Even at the point of making that decision, was there still an element of reluctance? Mm. How would you describe that feeling? And and that moment of making the decision, kind of going over the edge?
I got to the point where I dreaded it so much. I remember looking around, and I hadn't been on Instagram very long at that point. I wasn't public on Instagram at all, didn't start publicly. But I remember looking around, I saw a model called Cindy Joseph, who had been, I think she'd been grey for quite a while. And actually, sadly, she died of breast cancer. I'm not exactly sure what year she died, but she, absolutely stunning with long silver hair. And I remember thinking, wow, okay, that's different. Look how good she looks with it. She's not invisible. She's famous. She's very beautiful. And I started to see it differently. And then I started to see more and more people, because once you start looking for things, you start seeing them. And it inspired me, really. And I joined a group of sort of women online called the Silver Sisters. That's where I first came across the hashtag. And it sounds, I don't know, the Silver Sisters sounds a little bit, I don't know, I suppose, superficial in a way, but it's not. It's an absolutely incredible group of women internationally who all support each other. And we talk all the time and we know each other. And I began to get into that community, which was wonderful. And I started seeing hundreds of women who had let their hair go silver and were looking absolutely fine. So I thought, okay, it's not to be understated, I think, for a woman, how big a moment that is to go, okay, I'm going to let go. Because what you do when you're dyeing your hair is you're maybe it's not the same for everybody, because sometimes it's just a fun thing. So I do get that. But it's actually trying to reclaim your youth via your hair colour. It's saying, I'm not ageing. I'm covering up my greys. And that's not always the case. I do recognise that. For anybody listening, you might be thinking, well, that's not why I dye my hair. But for a lot of women, it is. It's cover up your greys because you don't want to have greys, because that's going to make you look old. Again, it's that shameful thing. So taking that step is massive. And you dread the thought of doing it. But I got to the point where I couldn't. And I actually think to myself, if I hadn't had allergies, probably wouldn't have stopped. But I'm so incredibly thankful that I did, because it's meant that I don't have to dye my hair. I don't have that toxic stuff on my head anymore. I don't have the cost of it. I don't waste the time doing it. It's allowed me to wear colours that I stopped suiting because I had the wrong colour hair. It's just so many bonuses. Plus, I've joined this amazing community of women. I get to do what I'm doing now, which is I would never have guessed what I was going to end up doing. And so, yeah, it was dreadful. And the start of it was hard, until I got a couple of inches in, and then it actually just got easier and easier.
It does take quite a long time. It
took a couple of years.
Yeah. Mm.
Because I grew it out. Some women do it in different ways. So there's an awful lot more knowledge about how you can help someone dye it silver, which I wouldn't recommend. Could go into that, but it's not the best for your hair. But what I would say, if anyone's out there thinking of doing the transition to silver, do it. Just do it. Because in going through that, as long as you join some communities and get some support, in going through that journey, you find yourself on the way. It changes you, because it just sounds such a tiny thing in a way, but it's not. It's massive. You, in going through that, you learn to accept yourself more for who you are, because you're not hiding yourself in a way anymore. It's a way of just accepting who you are and actually growing it out and going through almost the embarrassment of having half of your hair one colour and half another. It's like a lesson in, I don't know, humility in a sense. You're just like, I don't care about my hair right now. I'm going through this to get to an end point. And yeah, I just think it's something that is very worth doing, because you grow on the way.
And in what particular ways do you feel that you've grown?
More confident, being online and talking to the women across the world who have such a similar viewpoint. I can now voice how I feel about things more confidently. It's just having a mouthpiece and having something that you're part of that you can appreciate, that you can share with other women. That is a journey that they've all been on as well. And I've made friends. I meet up with those women now, and they're amazing. And we have so much fun together. Because everyone's kind of coming from the same point, and we all got to the same point where we just like can't do this anymore. So everyone's kind of similar in their growth and their mindset, and that's how you feel. You just feel free. There's a freedom about it that you don't have when you are constantly tied to dyeing your hair. If I give you a quick example, I used to book up all of my hair appointments for most of the year in advance because I couldn't let the hair grow out. So, and I'd make sure that I got my Christmas one in because I didn't want to miss that one, because that's the one where you need to look your best for Christmas. And it just seems to me now so superficial that I, or sad that I had to do that. That pressure on me, the pressure is insane to look a certain way. And now I don't have to. And now I can just wear what I like, when I like, and wear my hair how I like. And there's no pressure on me.
You mentioned confidence, and I know in some of your writing you've described that as a bit of sass. Mm-hmm. That's kind of come through. Is there a part of you that thinks, why didn't I do this sooner?
Oh, absolutely. But I just think it was a time. It was my time. It was the time of lots of women who somehow societally had got to the point where they're like, what? And also, so many women have reactions to hair dye. It's nasty stuff. It's got over 5,000 chemicals in it. It's toxic. So you're putting things on your head that you shouldn't be putting in close contact with skin, or, you know. So, yeah. And I absolutely, yeah, I do wish I'd done it earlier. But if I'd done it earlier, I wouldn't have potentially what I have now. So, you know. And if I'm honest, I wish I'd never started dyeing my hair. And it's interesting because my daughter doesn't dye her hair, and she's got some silver hairs coming through, and she's cool with it. And a lot of younger women now, there's thousands of younger women on Instagram looking absolutely stunning with silver salt and pepper, just strands of silver. And it makes me feel fantastic to see that, because that's changing the dialogue, that's changing the narrative. That story is being told differently now. Young women aren't going to be so ashamed. There's still an element of it. I get lots of comments, you know, you look 10 years older, why don't you dye your hair, you know, all those kinds of things. Well, that's people are entitled to their opinion, but that's the old construct. Things are changing, and it's, there shouldn't be any shame tied to it, and I'm so happy to see that there isn't as much as there was. So.
Did that profile and that building and that documenting of your story, your transition, and your advocacy for silver hair, silver sisters, that kind of stuff, was that a deliberate, I want to do this, I want to become someone who can tell this story, or did it just happen organically?
So the content creation started organically because I started to want to have fun with it. And when I left my job, I wanted to have more fun. That was, you know, part of my journey was that I got to a point kind of menopausally and in my life where I just felt like I needed something different, and I wanted to be more creative. And I've always been quite a creative person. I've always written. I have spates where I paint. I have spates where I try and learn guitar, and I used to sing a bit. And so I'm a fairly creative person. So I wanted to do something creative. And I'm fascinated with computers and things as well. So learning to make reels and use the technology, it was amazing. And it fun, really good fun. So I just started to do the odd little reel here and there. But I kind of always try to do it with a bit of a message if I can, because I'm not against anyone who just takes stunningly beautiful pictures of themselves and put them on, you know. Every single person can do it their own way. I just always feel like I kind of need to put something with it, if I can, to say a viewpoint on something, or an angle, or have you thought about this, or here's what I'm doing that's helping with this kind of thing. It feels, oh, it's quite manical. yeah, it just feels like I should do that, and that feels good to me. It feels worthwhile then that I'm doing something. I'm creating content, but it's got a message and it's got a worthwhile angle to it for people that it might be useful for. So to answer your question, I didn't really start it with that mission in mind. It kind of grew organically. And then and a friend at work, actually, when I was working, it's kind of her fault, and she knows who she is. We were talking one day, and she said about influencing and how much fun it was. And I remember thinking, why can't I do that? Why can't I be a bit more open and start doing something like that? Because it looks really good fun, and it doesn't look terribly hard. How wrong was I? Because there are elements to it that are really hard. But I started, and that knowledge gradually grew, and so I got better and better at doing the things that I do, and that's just a work in progress, which I love. I absolutely love it. It's fascinating learning how to do it, and actually scary as well, all at the same time. The first few reels I put out, where you're actually speaking or something, or you know, lip syncing something for a laugh, or just mucking around, were terrifying. But it actually doesn't really matter, because there's so many people doing it. It doesn't matter. But when you first put your own thing out there, and you put your face out there for the first time, yeah, that's a that's a moment, and you take a deep breath before you do that, and then actually you realise it didn't really matter that you did that, because it just kind of went into the ether, and a couple of people might have commented, and it didn't matter. So you just get a bit more brazen with it, and a bit more sassy, and you realise that sometimes when you say something, you will get some comments back, and sometimes if there's a bit of controversy, that's good, because you get a good narrative going, and you know that's also pretty cool. So yeah, I love it.
So then in 2021, a couple of years ago, you're loving this new confident version of yourself, you're loving your network, you're loving the content that you're creating, and you come face to face with another huge challenge.
Yes. Yeah, so I had another breast cancer. I can't say it's a recurrence because it wasn't the same one. So I have lots of breast cancer in my family, very, very strong down my mother's line. My mother's had it, my grandmother had it. My aunt had it, so my grandmother and my aunt both died of breast cancer. There's other family members, female family members on that side who've had breast cancer or breast problems, and also my mum. And I had my first breast cancer when I was 34. And so when it recurred, it was a different cancer in the same breast, in virtually the same place, which I think is probably quite unusual. Very small. Because I have regular mammograms, so I'm going to use this opportunity, if I can, just to say to all the women out there, please go and get your mammograms, because catching it early is key, and it means that you may have just the minimal treatment for it, which is brilliant nowadays, and you may not have to have all of the treatments that you hear about. So just anyone out there who's not having it regularly, please go and get your mammograms. The sort of lead into getting the second breast cancer is quite a long, complicated story, so I'm not going to go into that. But I had my mammogram. I gave up my job in February. I had my mammogram in the March, and I was diagnosed with cancer. So I had left my job, planning to be creative, change my life, go in a different direction, and I was just so excited about it. I can't tell you. It was this great future, you know, that I knew I would enjoy. I didn't know where it was going, and that was exciting. And then the breast cancer appeared. And it was like someone had just chucked a great big wall up in front of me. It just stopped everything. And I've spoken about this on some of the lives. It always chokes me up, so just go with me. It's like someone just shrinks your life to the next 5 minutes. It's just so hard to suddenly face your mortality again. And I didn't really deal with it very well the first time, so I just shut it away. So it was massive. And this time, I didn't talk about it. My daughter was very young, and I didn't talk about it. It just really gets me every single time. So this time I decided I wasn't going to just not talk about it. And I had a platform. I'd just started doing some stuff publicly. And I just thought, you know, I'm just going to put it out there. I had massive support from friends and family, people I'd worked with. Everybody was brilliant. And I just thought, if it helps someone, go and get a mammogram. I'm going to put it out on social media. And I had a massive response to it, which was incredible. And I only put it out the week before I went and had the operation. And I was very lucky. It hadn't spread, although I didn't know that at the time. But it was just a small cancer, and it got caught early. And I had huge support from everybody. And it was one of the best things I could have done, because it meant I had to then talk about it and try and come to terms with what had happened. And although I'm emotional about it, I'm in so much a better place than I was when I had the first one, because I had all the treatments the first time. I had the chemo, the radiation therapy, the hormone therapy, and this time I didn't have to have anything after I had the operation. Now, the operation was hard enough. I had a double mastectomy and reconstruction, which is, I've actually only just been signed off from, because I have had problems and had to have another operation last year. But that was worth going through, particularly because I didn't have to have chemo, which was, you know, something I really didn't want to have to do. So that was a massive challenge, and it has been over the last couple of years, really. It's 2 years since I left work now, and I've only just been signed off from the cancer. So all the way through my Instagram journey, I've been battling with, when I say battling, I don't really like the word. I don't like the word survivor, as in a sense, for myself. Although in a sense, mentally, I survived it. But all the way through that time, I've been challenged by physical problems to do with what I've had done. And so, it's been interesting trying to work with the two sides of myself, really, and try and join the two, because what I've done is I've tried to feed one into the other and inform my content creation around, in some respects, what's happened to me. And that's what's led me to things like the Clean Beauty and trying to maximize my health, because I also recently had the results from a genetic test. And although there is very strong breast cancer links in my family, I don't have a gene that caused my breast cancer that they can find at the moment. I'm still having another panel done next year, and they're bringing in new genes that they're looking for all the time. And I've had a panel of, I think, like 7 or something. They've tested for 7 genes or something, and I don't have any of them. There's no markers, which is insane, isn't it? When you think about how much breast cancer there is in my family, they can't find a gene that would mean that's created that, caused it. So what's interesting for me then is that if I've had no genetic link, why did I get breast cancer twice? So that's led me to think, I think it's only 5-10% of cancers are genetic. Therefore, you know, the rest of the percentages are environmentally linked. So it's things that we're doing to ourselves that are causing the cancers. So I'm trying to minimize the elements of the sort of chemicals I come in contact with, the toxic things. I'm looking at what I eat. I'm looking at my health in so many different ways to try and maximize my life, because I've hopefully won't get cancer again. I certainly can't get breast cancer again, but if it's migrated to another part of my body, I want to be maximizing my health and trying as best I can to stop toxic chemicals coming into contact with myself that might stimulate my hormones. And, you know, we're just surrounded by them. The chemical burden that we face daily in our lives is huge, from the carpets that you have, to the furniture, to the air pollution, to plastics, to anything you put on your body, to petrochemicals that are in just about everything we use, to what you put on your head. You know, the irritation and inflammation that those things can cause in your body is huge. So for me, going through the breast cancer has meant that I now want to mitigate those as much as I can and try and live a healthier life.
Finally then, you're just over halfway through your life as a 50ist.
I am.
Or the 50ist.
The 50ist.
Do you have anything that you would have said to yourself 7-8 years ago going into this decade of your life?
Oh goodness, absolutely. Be brave. just, if you feel like you want to do something, and I know everybody says this, but it's changed my life, just being brave. Just trying something I didn't think I could do. Moving it is, and changing tack. Just change tack. If you can't get something to work that way, just tweak it a bit and go in a certain different direction. Be brave because you're going to fail. And then it just sounds so cheesy because everybody says it, but it's the reason everyone says it is because it's true. You have to fail to learn from it to grow. And so I'm really passionate about that. I think I would tell myself from 7 or 8 years ago, it's okay, it's going to be fine. And it's that whole thing, this too shall pass, isn't it? Like, nothing is forever. When you're in the worst moments of things, time will move things on, and then it will be either better or different. And so I think I would tell myself that. I'd say, you just be brave and also be kind. Be kind to yourself and be kind to other people, because there isn't enough of that. And I see a lot online of people being unkind, and there's just no need for it. And I think that's people projecting their own unhappiness onto other people, and that's, you know, sad for them in their situation. But I still don't want people to do it, you know. And the more we say that out loud, the better, really. The more we say, look after yourself. Yeah, look after yourself. And can I say one more thing? Is keep your map open. I call it your map. Just look for new things, try new things, read new things, educate yourself on something you're interested in, and try it and go in that direction, because it'll either work for you or it won't work for you. And that's the whole thing of life, isn't it? If you don't try, if you don't change anything, nothing changes. So it's just keep your map open, be a sponge, try new things.
Julie, we're now going to play Somerset location or obscure movie title.
I can't wait.
Which is the game where I have 8 names and you have to tell me whether you think they are places in Somerset or obscure movie titles.
Okay.
Are you a big movie fan?
I am.
Okay.
I love movies. I'm going to be terrible at this though. I feel it in my bones.
So your first one is The Clink.
It's a movie title or place name, right? Place name.
It is a place name. It's in Bridgewater.
Ah, okay. I haven't heard of it.
Nope.
But The Clink could be, is also, isn't that another name for a prison?
Yeah, there is a Clink Street or something in London where there used to be a prison. Right. So yeah, usually.
Because I did think for a second, okay, that could be, it's quite a plausible movie. Nicely done. Mm.
Number 2 is Monday's Mead.
Place name.
Is a place name.
I can't believe this. Okay.
It's in Wincanton.
As in mead, as in the drink?
Mead, M-E-A-D.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Number 3 is Cross of Iron.
Movie.
It is a movie.
Oh, come on!
It's a war film.
I love this game.
directed by Sam Peckinpah.
Okay. Wait.
Of The Getaway fame, I think he did that. All right, number 4. And you're on a roll so far.
I know.
No pressure. Number 4 is Munger Road.
Say it again.
Munger Road.
Place.
It's a film.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
It's a
horror. It sounds like a road.
It's a horror film from 2011.
Right. Wow. Okay.
Presumably about people getting killed on Munger Road.
Oh. By undoubtedly.
Someone.
With blood. Lots of blood.
Your next one is Brass Knocker Hill.
Place.
It is a place.
Okay. Where's that then?
It's in Bath.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So a little bit further away.
But... is it the posh place where all of them had brass knockers, do you think?
It might have been. Mm. There's a lot of posh places in Bath.
Yeah, though. A lot of posh.
Next one is Across the Tracks.
That does not sound like a place name. That definitely sounds like a film.
It is a film.
Yes.
From 1990.
Okay.
It's a drama that has Brad Pitt in it.
Oh, and I love Brad Pitt, and I've not heard of that.
It's one of his early works,
right?
Pre Thelma and Louise.
Right.
So
okay.
Very early Brad Pitt.
Right. Are you a movie buff then?
I like a film or two. Yeah. Yeah. So we have 2 more left.
Okay.
Your next one is Little Trumps.
That is, well, unless it's about a very famous man and like the younger version of them.
I'm not going to say anything.
Oh, okay. It could be. It absolutely could be, couldn't it? Oh, it sounds like a place name. Is it an ongoing place name?
It's a place name.
Ah, oh, good, good.
So I think you've only got one wrong so far. Am I right?
Yeah, was it one or two? Anyway.
Yeah, the only one you got wrong was Munger Road, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that puts you on 6.
Okay.
Which so far is the most anyone's got. No one's got 7, no one's got 8.
I'm a bit competitive.
And your final name is Scarlet Street.
Scarlet Street. Film.
It's a film.
Come on! I love this game. I wouldn't have been saying that if I had had no wins by now, but I absolutely, yeah, brilliant game.
It's a 1945 film noir.
Right.
Directed by Fritz Lang.
Okay.
Of Metropolis fame.
Yes, yeah.
But well done.
Yeah.
That was a good showing.
I love that. What a great game. Do I win something? No.
No.
Okay.
Before we go, where can people find out more about you, your journey, what you're doing, the content you're creating, that kind of thing?
So I'm at The 50est on Instagram, also on Facebook, and also on TikTok. That's a new venture for me, and I don't have a lot on there, but I am sort of venturing into that area as well. And I'm hoping to have a website coming sometime this year. So that would be great. If you want to check me out, yeah, I'd love to see you. Come along and say hi.
Fabulous. Julie, thank you so much for your time. It's been great talking to you. You've been a wonderful guest.
Thank you. It's been really, really great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Somerset Stories is a Whitstone production and music is provided by Jezzar under Creative Commons.